growing Latino population.
Jessica, early reports suggest that this building had some fire code violations. What do you know about that, and how common of a problem is this in New York City?
Yeah, so we haven't been able to confirm yet whether there were code violations here or not. We talked to the fire department and they weren't able to confirm that yet. But the issue of code violations and building violations generally is a huge problem here in New York, especially in areas that are gentrifying. There's often a concern that landlords are letting their buildings go into disrepair in order to push out tenants and flip them for higher rents. We don't know if that's the case here, but the city has really been trying to crack down on landlords who let that happen.
Jessica Gould of member station WNYC. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, homeowners across the country are scrambling to prepay their 2018 property taxes. Starting on Monday, a new rule comes into effect as part of the Republican tax overhaul. On your federal taxes, you'll only be able to deduct up to $10,000 in what you pay in state and local taxes. And many people thought they saw a way to beat the clock here. They have tried to prepay their property taxes fast so they could deduct them on their 2017 taxes. But the IRS seemed to suggest Wednesday that they should not be doing this, and that has left many people in legal limbo. With time running short, tax collectors are scrambling. Here is Lydia Lazinski, a tax collector in Montclair, New Jersey.
It's been very chaotic. I said it before, it's like a revolving door. People coming in, people going out. We are getting phone calls nonstop. The phones are literally, they just don't stop. Today, we had a line of people, you know, waiting for us at 8 o'clock when we don't even open until 8:30. And people just have a lot of questions, and they are here, you know, with their checkbooks and ready to write out the payments. It's just been traffic nonstop.
All right, people have a lot of questions. Let's try to answer as many as we can with David Harrison. He has been covering this story for the Wall Street Journal. David, thanks for coming in.
Sure thing.
This sounds like a total mess.
Yeah, it seems that way. It seems like in a number of jurisdictions, a number of tax collectors' offices, people are lining up, as we just heard. And it seems like this is, you know, people are really trying to pay in advance so they can deduct these taxes from their 2017 federal tax returns.
Which seemed like something that would make sense as people heard about the Republican tax bill. But the IRS feels differently. They issued this new guidance on Wednesday limiting who could do this. What exactly is the IRS saying here?
So the IRS is saying you can only do this, first of all, if your locality allows it, which is not the case everywhere. And secondly, if you've already been assessed, if your property has already been assessed for 2018. Now, there's some question, like, what exactly does assessed mean? Do you have to have received a bill or is simply an assessment enough? And then there's a broader question of, is the IRS even right in its determination? I mean, I talked to some tax lawyers who say that you can prepay what you estimate you would own, even if your property hasn't been assessed, and that might still pass legal muster. So essentially, what the IRS has done in a way has made this much more complicated and more confusing.
Because, I mean, the Republicans have been talking about for a long time that they're going to simplify the tax code, which at least in this one instance right now, it's seeming like very much the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. And so what you have right now, you know, what you have is this tax bill was signed into law just a few days ago, and it goes into effect a few days from now. And it's, you know, as all things related to taxes are very complicated and involves, you know, rules and laws in all kinds of jurisdictions. And so it's going to take a while to sort everything out.
So if I'm a homeowner, you are saying that local communities really have the ultimate control here, that even if the IRS said you can, in theory, prepay these taxes, my city or locality could say, like, no, we're not going to let you come in and do this?
Yeah, that's right. And cities and localities across the country are sort of taking different approaches here. So some places are saying, we will allow you to prepay your taxes, but only those taxes for which you have received a bill. Because a lot of places, you know, bill on a quarterly basis or bill twice a year. So some of these places are saying, you received a bill, fine, come on in. Other places are saying, you know what, just come on in, pay what you think you might owe. That's the case, say, in Fairfax County, Virginia.
Just come up with some kind of estimate?
Come up with some estimate because, you know, you've paid, presumably you've paid your property taxes the last few years. You have a vague idea of what you might owe. You're not intending to move. So you sort of have a pretty good sense. And then some other places are saying, you know, just we'll we haven't billed you yet, but we've assessed you. And so based on that assessment, you can come in and pay. That's the case in D.C. So all these places are taking a very different approach. There's some places as well that have already billed for the full year 2018. So there they're saying, you know, come on in, pay your taxes.
And maybe it'll work, or the IRS will say that you can't do this. I mean, it's all a... That's all an open question.
Exactly. And so the question is, you know, once we figure out what exactly the IRS means, which this has been sorted out, some of these people have already paid, and they paid before the IRS issued its guidance. So are they all of a sudden going to get audited? Are they all in trouble? Or imagine you paid Tuesday before the guidance. Your neighbor wants to pay today after the guidance. Are you in somehow different legal situation?
So in just a few seconds, I mean, any last minute advice for people who have no idea what to do here?
As always with taxes, call your advisor.
Okay. We should say you're not an advisor, you're a reporter,
not,
so no one should take your advice necessarily.
Not at all.
Call your tax advisor. All right, David Harrison is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for coming in.
Sure thing. Thank you.
In Afghanistan today, families affected by a suicide bombing are saying their government is not doing enough to prevent violence. The bombing targeted a Shiite cultural center in Kabul yesterday. It killed 41 people. Many more were wounded. But as NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Islamabad, the Afghan government faces a lot of challenges.
The anger is palpable. One man tells a local news channel, Tolo, that all those killed were ordinary people. None were the sons of officials. The government vowed to investigate the attack. That's little comfort to residents. One researcher estimates ISIS inflicted nearly 20 attacks this year in Kabul. Kiran Nazish is writing a book on Afghanistan's security threats. She says the age of ISIS bombers is the first challenge to quelling the group in Kabul. Yesterday's attacker, she says, was...
a young child who looks roughly around 12, 13 maybe. The last three attacks at least that we've seen, that they all the suicide bombers are young children.
Many are out of school and they want what they see as adventure. And some are...
young boys who have been taken by both by Taliban and by ISIS because their families could not afford to, you know, feed them anymore.
Kabul is also filled with chief targets for ISIS, Shiites and security forces. And attacks there show the Western-backed government is weak. This is Burhan Osman. He's a senior researcher with the crisis group.
It is attractive and morale boosting for the group to carry out attacks which can easily make big headlines.
Osman says bombing the group's heartland in eastern Afghanistan is not enough. The country needs an effective counter-extremist strategy. Otherwise, he says, residents are losing faith in the government, and that could invite even more chaos. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
This is NPR News.
And it's 8:18. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. NPR headlines are coming up next, and during the WPR newscast, an historic train depot in Wausau is getting a makeover. Find out what it's becoming in a couple minutes during the WPR newscast.
Support comes from Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar, Williams Bay's Coffee House, offering fresh organic coffee and espresso drinks, affordable wines and beer, live music, and delicious dishes. Located next to Dip in the Bay in Williams Bay, visit BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
Act on the community. WPR is pleased to promote live theater. More information at WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The National Weather Service says record cold is being felt from New England to Arkansas. It's 10 to 15 degrees below zero this morning in parts of Maine. Quinn Kleinfelter with member station WDET has more from Detroit.
The icebox opened around Christmas Day in the Midwest. Since then, Flint, Michigan had its coldest December day on record, dropping to 17 degrees below zero, while Detroit reached 4 below zero. The frigid air is forecast to continue well past New Year's Day.
Authorities in New York City are investigating the cause of a deadly apartment fire in the Bronx. 12 people were killed. Several others are hospitalized. A fire in India has killed at least 15 people. The flames broke out early this morning at a rooftop restaurant in Mumbai. In Pakistan today, thousands of people turned out at a rally near Islamabad to hear from a cleric designated as a terrorist by the U.S. NPR's Dia Hadid reports on Hafez Saeed.
It was the largest gathering Saeed has held since he was released from house arrest just 4 weeks ago. The U.S. believes Saeed is the mastermind of a group that killed dozens of people in the 2008 Mumbai attacks, including six Americans. A political party linked to Saeed hopes to contest Pakistan's upcoming general elections. There are fears that these kinds of rallies will bolster their cause.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. An iconic train depot in Wausau will soon find new life as the city's first distillery. The 1901 depot became famous as the symbol for Wausau insurance in the 1950s. Dan Weber, the new distillery's co-owner, says he will create regional liquors for the building and try to attract tourists to its cocktail lounge.
We're actually moving forward to put it on the National Historic Registry because we're really trying to encapsulate the ambiance or the old feel of the train station with the brick walls and hardwood floors. And we're really doing our best to make it as historical as possible.
Historic buildings in Green Bay, La Crosse, Milwaukee, and Monroe have also found new life as distilleries or breweries. A SkyWest flight from Iowa to Detroit made an emergency landing in Milwaukee after a sudden loss of cabin pressure. SkyWest spokeswoman Marissa Snow tells the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the plane with 38 passengers and three crew members landed safely yesterday. She says a female passenger received treatment at a hospital because of pain in one of her ears, but later resumed her travels. Snow says the passengers continued their trip on a different plane while mechanical crews investigated what caused the loss in cabin pressure. The Federal Aviation Administration is also investigating. Cloudy day today in Wisconsin with a chance of light snow in the southern half of the state. Temperatures for the most part in the single digits. You're listening to WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, offering Kauffman Fast Track, a program which provides insights, templates, and guides to help aspiring entrepreneurs start businesses. More online at fasttrac.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults at home in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Learn more at 1-800-365-4189.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm David Green. When the year comes to a close this Sunday night, we'll have the stock market to thank for a good bit of good news in 2017. The Dow Jones has risen by more than 25% this year, and the other major indexes saw huge gains as well. NPR's Jim Zaroli explains why.
It was a year in which the Dow marched past one milestone after another, blowing through 21,000, 22,000, and then...
There we go. It is a record day as the Dow comes even close. We're only like 30, 40 points away from 23,000.
By yesterday, the Dow was at nearly 25,000. The surge in stock prices was great news for anyone with a retirement account and for a lot of other people as well. Josh Peters of Charlotte, North Carolina, saw his stock portfolio climb by 27%. He's about to quit working and enter a PhD program. So he says the money will come in handy.
It just gave me a lot more financial freedom to try different things and not be so concerned about my financial well-being.
No one seemed to talk about the stock market boom as much as President Trump. Before his election, Trump sometimes warned that stock prices were inflated. But this year, he used stock prices to vindicate his economic agenda. Here he was last summer.
The stock market hit an all-time record high today, over 22,000. We've picked up substantially now more than $4 trillion in net worth in terms of our country, our stocks, our companies.
In fact, many stock analysts say Trump's agenda of tax cuts and deregulation probably contributed to the boom. But the main reason for the surge has to do with global economic conditions. Stocks were up in much of the world. Paul Christopher is head of global market strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
The U.S., Europe, Japan, China, they're all growing together now for the first time since 2007. And what that's done is to really boost confidence all around the world, and that's really brought more money into equity markets.
Christopher says U.S. corporate profits were unexpectedly strong this year, and consumers were buying a lot. Credit card debt is growing. But Wharton School finance professor Jeremy Siegel says regardless of what the stock market has done, there's not a lot of evidence yet that overall economic growth is increasing as much.
I mean, I see some encouraging signs the last two quarters, last three quarters, but I'm not ready to say that a new trend has really been established.
And Siegel says he doesn't expect Washington to do much to change that. Now that the tax bill has been signed into law, the benefits of the cuts have already been priced into the market. Siegel says given the sharp partisan divide in Washington, Congress is unlikely to accomplish anything else of real economic significance. And that means 2018 is unlikely to be as good a year for stocks as 2017 has been. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
The biggest lake in California was once a famed desert oasis, but now the Salton Sea is shrinking. Now, that's partly because of evaporation, but also its water is being redirected elsewhere thanks to a controversial deal, and that means the lake may soon be dry. John Nielsen has the story.
In the 1950s and the 1960s, tourists swarmed the shores of California's Salton Sea, which is actually a 350-square-mile lake in the southeastern corner of the state. There were nine marinas then. There were fancy restaurants, and there were stars like Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack.
Here is truly a miracle in the desert, a whole new outlet for the crowded millions in big cities, a Palm Springs with water.
Unfortunately, since the late 1970s, the place once called the Desert Riviera has been battered by floods, baked by drought, and poisoned by agricultural pollutants. Fish killed by algae blooms line some of the beaches. Abandoned resorts look like the sets of zombie movies. But the biggest blow of all could be the one that hits as the rivers that now sustain the Salton Sea shrink to a trickle. That's thanks to a farm-to-city water transfer deal that directs the water in those rivers to booming urban areas near San Diego. Critics say this deal could prove disastrous for hundreds of species of migratory birds that roost and feed in places like the Sunny Bono Wildlife Refuge. Al Kalin is a local farmer.
There aren't as many as there used to be, and the great blue herons are pretty much used to be. Well, you could see 100 great blue herons along the shore in one spot. Anymore, you're lucky if you see one or two.
Others have been warning of an air pollution crisis, arguing that dust clouds from the shrinking sea pose a threat to people living all over the southeastern part of California.
You guys can make a line over here so I could get your email and your name.
Concerned citizens who've heard those warnings recently filled a meeting room in the headquarters of Comité Cívico del Valle, a nonprofit public health group in the desert town of Brawley. Carolyn Garcia brought her along her children.
This is Damian Garcia. He has asthma and allergies. And then Destin Garcia also has asthma, but without allergies.
Towns like Brawley already have some of the highest asthma rates and worst air pollution problems in the country. Luis Olmedo of Comité Cívico says the Salton Sea dust storms will make those problems worse, noting that traces of everything from DDT to arsenic have been detected in the dried out lake beds.
It's like if we're going to a class one landfill, a toxic landfill, to expose it and just let the wind carry it to our community. That's really what's happening.
In August, after years of trying, California lawmakers unveiled a $383 million plan to minimize the impact of the water transfer deal. The plan would encircle what's left of the Salton Sea with thousands of acres worth of managed wetlands and freshwater fish ponds.
We like to say that we're creating a smaller but sustainable lake or Salton Sea.
Bruce Wilcox is the state official charged with implementing the mitigation plan, which has not yet been fully funded. If the funding does come through, Wilcox thinks it should be enough to keep the dust down and protect the birds. Wilcox says he does know people who dream of a return to the glory days of the Desert Riviera. But he says the glory days are gone. For NPR News, I'm John Nielsen, Brawley, California. This is NPR News.
Damon Bolte creates cocktails at his Grand Army Bar in New York, and he made one for us by request. It was stirred, not shaken.
For me, a martini is always something that's very clean and also slightly reflective. You know, it's something you sip on. You don't really slam it.
I'm Ari Shapiro. A new cocktail for the new year this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and coming up this hour still, it's Wisconsin Life. Today, a poet reflects on being raised with two cultural identities. That's Wisconsin Life in 15 minutes. Good morning. It's 8:30. I'm Maureen McCollum in Wisconsin Public Radio News. Two Wisconsin communities have been awarded nearly $500,000 each from the U.S. Department of Justice to improve response to sexual assault and domestic violence crimes. Daniel Kading has more.
The city of Superior and Sauk County were among 50 applicants nationwide to receive the grant. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says their $440,000 grant will fund a detective to work solely on domestic violence cases.
To have somebody dedicated to the follow-up and to give the victim special attention and to dedicate investigative resources to, that's certainly going to have an impact.
Alexander hopes the funding will help with making victims feel safe and improving accountability among offenders. An assistant district attorney for Sauk County says they hope to strengthen relationships between the DA's office, law enforcement, and a victim advocate group to improve the experience for victims in the criminal justice system. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin legislature has invited Governor Scott Walker to give his annual State of the State speech on January 24th. Republican leaders sent Walker a letter yesterday with the invitation. The governor is expected to use the speech to lay out his priorities for 2018. This is WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, dedicated to providing student aid and attracting new scholars through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More at supportuw.org.
Supporting WGTD is the Metropolitan Opera, whose next high-definition simulcast is Saturday, January 27th, Puccini's Tosca, at Kenosha's Tinseltown and Racine's Renaissance Theater. For more information, you can go to metopera.org.
Cloudy day today in Wisconsin. Another light snow chance across the southern half of the state. About 1 inch possible along I-94, and anywhere from 1 to 3 inches possible southwest of Madison and near the Illinois border. It's going to be really cold again, with temperatures for the most part in the single digits and even colder wind chills.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Melville Charitable Trust, driven by one goal, ending homelessness for good. Learn more online at melvilletrust.org and on Twitter at @MelvilleTrust. From Care.com, offering home pay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. It started as a hashtag, MeToo. It has turned into a movement of women saying no more to sexual harassment and assault. In October, the film producer Harvey Weinstein was accused by multiple women of sexual misconduct, and that sparked a moment of reckoning. It took down powerful men in entertainment, politics, and media, including here at NPR. Megan Garber has been following the Me Too movement. She's a writer for The Atlantic, and I asked her why this year.
I think a lot of that had to do with Donald Trump and the Access Hollywood tape. There was a real sense, I think, among a lot of American women, among a lot of American people, really, that he had basically claimed to sexually assault women on tape. He had been recorded, you know, bragging about this. And yet he was elected president of the United States. And I think a lot of people just felt a really strong sense of not just indignation about that, but a sense of regression that, you know, all the progress that feminism had made, that we had made as a society, was not actually progress at all. There was still misogyny rampant. And so I think that the anger of that really helped fuel this movement.
Donald Trump, of course, was elected president, but many powerful men have lost their jobs in the wake of allegations. And I wonder, what's really interesting is that even after they have been fired or resigned, it seems like organizations and companies are having a really hard time with messaging. What do you think is the problem here?
I think we just don't have good systems in place to deal with all of these sort of situations. I think we're finding out now how few companies actually have HR departments to begin with, HR departments that are functional. And we just, I think, don't have good norms set up to deal with this. We're not used to talking about these issues in public. And that's one of the reasons I think this movement is so productive, is that it's forcing us to have the conversations.
I had this conversation with my brother the other day that I will never forget, where he essentially said to me, he's like, you know, I think of myself as a good guy, and what I don't understand is how I should be an ally. Have you had conversations with men in your life about what the quote-unquote good guys should be doing?
Very much so, and I'm so glad that that's part of where this conversation is going, because it's so important. You know, this is a systemic problem. This is not just about individual instances of harassment. It's not just about, you know, men and women operating together in the workplace and beyond. It's really about who we are as a culture and a society. And if we are going to make progress, if we are going to make the world more equitable and just, we're going to need everyone having the conversation. And I'm so glad that men are starting to step up.
I have read several worrying hot takes about the coming backlash. You can't have a movement, you can't have a reckoning without also having a backlash. Do you think there are things for women to worry about, women and their allies to worry about?
Certainly, I do. But I also think just the magnitude of it in such a short amount of time really does suggest that this is a systemic movement itself. And I think because of that, yes, there will be backlash. And I think in general, there's always backlash when it comes to social upheaval and social progress. And that's generally how these movements have gone. You know, but I think we're at the point now where even if, I mean, a lot of people talk about the nightmare scenario where one of the allegations proves not to be true.
Yeah.
But I think even in that situation, it sort of transcended the individual stories at this point in the best way.
Megan Garber is a writer for The Atlantic. She's been covering the Me Too movement. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When you think of an electric bike or a moped, you might think of someone using these things for fun. But elsewhere in the world, from Mexico City to Shanghai, these smaller vehicles are actually vital forms of transportation. They're more affordable. They also help alleviate congestion. Well, now some West Coast startups think mopeds and scooters might present those same advantages here in the United States as well, as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
About 10 years ago, electric bikes were having kind of a renaissance. This is from a story by my former NPR colleague, John McChesney. And for context, John is a baby boomer pedaling up a hill in San Francisco with the aid of an e-bike.
This is pretty extraordinary, because I can tell you, on this hill, I would never, ever attempt it. But I'm still working out. As you can probably begin to hear, okay, rest break.
As that story shows, an e-bike can help you up a steep hill in San Francisco, and they're an alternative to gas-powered motors. Now, some of those smaller gas-powered motors can be more polluting than cars, and that's why a number of startups in Oregon and Southern California have sprouted up to help the commuter who wants something clean and somewhere between a bike and a car. When you stand at the front of this tiny manufacturing shop in downtown Pasadena that has about half a dozen workers, you can imagine what Henry Ford or Ransom Old's first car assembly shops looked like. Kind of like this. This startup is called Urby. They make foldable scooters.
As you can see, like station 4 and 5 is where it all kind of comes together a little bit more.
More than 80% of workers in the U.S. get to work alone in a car, truck, or SUV. Now, environmentalists have long seen this as a problem, with a new wave of entrepreneurs sensing opportunity.
My name is Peter Lee. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Urbi. Urbi stands for Urban Electric. We exist to solve the pain points of living in cities.
Lee says the biggest pain point, traffic.
So using an Uber and Lyft is great and very convenient, but using a 3,000-pound car to move a 150, 180-pound body 1 or 2 miles doesn't seem very convenient or efficient to us.
Lee says these vehicles solve the problem of the last mile. You know, the trip to the grocery store or those 8 blocks to the nearest bus or train. Now, these startups want to make those trips easier and cleaner.
There needs to be a different class of vehicle. It could be scooters, it could be electric bikes, it could be kick scooters, it could be a lot of different things. But driving around in everybody's own personal automobile is not the way forward.
Ryan Respecki is CEO of Jump Mobility. His company makes a shared electric bike.
One, you're not going to get sweaty because you're not exerting yourself nearly as much. Two, you can go up the hills, no problem. Three, you can wear normal clothes. And four, it is cooler.
As cities around the globe look to ban cars in their central business districts and parking remains a premium, entrepreneurs say these small vehicles are there to fill in the gaps.
Both feet are on the ground right now. Your right hand is on our throttle, so go ahead and twist that throttle back a little bit, slightly.
Oh.
There you go.
Peter Lee with Urbi lets me go on a joy ride.
And as you go, you can just put your feet on the back pegs, and both feet will come up, and there you go. And the right hand is the brake.
I think I scared that lady there. If I don't come back, Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And it is 8:41 on this chilly Friday morning. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we'll bring you NPR headlines. That's followed by WPR headlines. And after that, it's Wisconsin Life. When you give to Wisconsin Public Radio, you have a powerful impact. You make WPR the place that hundreds of thousands of people turn to for independent news, statewide discussions, and inspiring music, as well as laughter, just when you need it. WPR is listener-supported, and that means you make a difference. So make your tax-deductible year-end gift right now at WPR.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. There's no word yet on what sparked a deadly fire at an apartment building in New York City. NPR's Joel Rose says it left 12 people dead and several hospitalized in the Bronx.
The fire began just before 7 in the evening in a 5-story apartment building near the Bronx Zoo. The city's fire commissioner says it started on the first floor and then spread to the upper floors. He called the fire historic in magnitude, but said it was just too soon to talk about what might have caused it.
Some residents used the building's fire escapes to flee the smoke and flames. A fire at a rooftop restaurant in India has killed at least 15 people. That fire broke out early this morning in Mumbai. Authorities say most of those killed were attending a birthday party. In Cambodia, a political opposition leader is being ordered to pay $1 million in damages for defaming the country's prime minister. As Michael Sullivan reports, some are calling this government intimidation ahead of next year's general election.
Hun Sen has been in power more than 30 years. He said earlier this week he plans on staying for 10 more. The verdict against opposition leader Sam Rongzi, already in exile, isn't surprising. A few months back, Hun Sen's government arrested another opposition leader, Kamsul Ka, for treason and dissolved the opposition party altogether. Independent news media and civil society groups have also been targeted.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. UW Stout's Student Center was flooded Wednesday night due to a suspected frozen pipe. Video shot by custodial staff showed streams of water pouring from light fixtures onto a student dining area. University spokesman Doug Mell says the broken pipe was part of the building's sprinkler system. He says a drop in pressure after 8 p.m. alerted the city fire department. No students were in the building at the time. Mell says the amount of damage has not been determined yet.
we really have no way of knowing. A lot of it depends on, obviously, our cleanup costs, but also how much of that ceiling has to be repaired, and then how much stuff is actually lost. I mean, that's all going to take a while to sort out.
Mel says the university is hoping to finish repairs before students return January 22nd. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources officials say they have not made any final decisions about when and where camping in state park fees could increase in the new year. The Republican state budget contains provisions that go into effect Monday, allowing DNR Secretary Dan Meyer to raise camping fees by as much as $15 per night at sites of his choosing and park entry fees by as much as $5 per day at parks of his choosing. DNR spokesman James Dick says no final decisions about where to raise fees or by how much have been made. He says the agency hopes to put something together early in the new year. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CDW, offering CDW Cloud Consulting, committed to helping companies develop smart, strategic cloud solutions to maximize their cloud investment. CDW, people who get it. From the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, supporting the health and well-being of underserved populations at langloth.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Tina Bowling grew up challenged by both whites and Latinos about her identity. Her household identified as Chicano, but she wasn't raised knowing Spanish. She explores that tension in the poem she's sharing with us today and tells us a bit about its creation.
On the road away from my Midwest home, sitting in a cafe on the U.S. East Coast, I order my tea, buy a book, and sit and write a poem. Then Spanish hits me, first like a chirping of pretty tunes, and I love it. I close my eyes for a second. It smells like busy kitchens, crowded streets, and warm smiles. But this is different, because we are on a college campus. This is Castilian Spanish. I laugh at my thought of chirp, chirp. I type, continue on with my poem in Ingles. Soon, my subconscious lays out a welcome mat, as if waiting for this moment. I know if I silently, patiently waited, it would come to me. I chuckle at their teasing, talk of school, professors, wishing I could join them, but knowing I wouldn't. I'm not fluent. They fly higher than I do. Their words transform into a context that can store in my stomach, nourishing the corners left unswept. Undiscovered, I guard them there, won't claim them, because they aren't mine. I am always reminded of that. This isn't mine. They are the breadcrumbs to part of my heritage, one I was blended into, that welcomes my brown hair and eyes, my Latina hips, and hard-to-place facial features, until I speak. I don't speak Spanish. I hardly move nor look up, afraid to disturb this moment, afraid it might fly away. I want to enjoy it in its natural environment, not caged in a novella or recorded in a song. I enjoy the natural rhythm. It plays on my olive-colored skin. La música enters my body, or my body entre la música. No se, just is. I want to capture this moment. I write quickly and quietly. Tap, tap, tap. They leave. A void enters the room. I am way too familiar with this void. The air falls heavy on my shoulder. I stop writing. Their currents. The thought crosses my mind to toss the breadcrumbs, the same one shared with me, hoping to bring it back. But some things cannot be captured to be enjoyed, only missed. What this is capturing, some of the pieces that you feel like you're missing because you don't quite belong. I'm mixed race, multiracial, and so are you enough of this? Are you enough of that? I felt like I was challenged, you know, and so I would always say, what are the qualifiers? What are the things that make someone more of the side who's German, Norwegian, or more that's, you know, Mexican American, Native American. What does that mean? So those are the elements that are underlying a lot of the experience which is put into this poem. Because when I came up, that I could see, there weren't as many kids who were of mixed race, multiracial backgrounds, and so you didn't really, you felt the pressure to have to identify as one or the other, and you never quite fit. And so, but now, I think demographics have changed considerably. To me, that gives me the hope that the dialogue will shift. Everything I write initially is for self because it's a processing tool for me. And then I risk it by putting it out to other people to say, if you find this of use, if this is something that can help you, like it helped me, I share it in that manner.
That was Tina Bowling. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And today is Erica Janik's last day at WPR. She's moving on to a wonderful opportunity at New Hampshire Public Radio. Erica's been a part of Wisconsin Life since it started. She's brought us countless stories from people all across the state. Funny stories, moving ones, fascinating looks at Wisconsin history, and memorable commentaries. We will miss her very dearly. Wisconsin Life will continue on WPR. And don't worry, Erica has left us with plenty of new features, so she will be with us on the air for a while.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to tune in for Live From Here this weekend as we look back at some of the amazing performances that we've had the pleasure of hearing in 2017. What a list it was. Randy Newman, Fiona Apple, Bon Iver, Carmen Lynch, George Saunders, just to name a few. We're wishing you all a very happy and safe new year, and we look forward to visiting with you again with a month of live shows in January.
Saturday night at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Cloudy day today across Wisconsin with another light snow chance across the southern half of the state. It's going to be incredibly cold once again with temperatures in the single digits.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Sherwood Game Farm, offering locally raised beef and pork and chicken, duck, and turkey, raised without antibiotics, added hormones, steroids, or cages. The market is open at the Roadie Saturday from 10 until 2.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Each year, around this time, we bring you a montage of music. What all the sounds have in common is that they were produced by musicians we lost in the year that is coming to an end. And in 2017, we lost some pioneers of rock and roll, Fats Domino and Chuck Berry. There was, of course, Tom Petty. There were giants of jazz like John Hendricks and Mujal Richard Abrams, country legend Mel Tillis, and so many more. So let's listen here and say goodbye to some of our favorites.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Is that a shame?
Last time I saw Marie, she's waving me goodbye with hurry home drops on her cheek that trickle from her eye.
To blow, but we don't know how time can fly and how 1 hour can pass away. We wish that time would never go so we could take our time and blow till the day. For brothers, for brothers, for brothers, not just one final word.
I'm happy to know you and I know I won't forget you.
There's no blood, there's no love.
s'étale comme un soleil d'été et que ton oreiller ressemble au champ de blé.
Pour plaisir, il soll le child on the
location when the slugs penetrate, feel a burning sensation, getting closer to God in a tight situation now.
For all that I've blessed and all that I've wronged in dreams until my death, I will wander on.
We had a dream, we'd go traveling together. A little love and it will keep moving on. Something always happens whenever we're together. We get a happy feeling when we're singing a song.
It's like a favorite song that we love to sing. Every time we hear the music, we got the kind that lasts forever.
Well, I ain't never seen nobody like you. No, 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 never.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Goode.
Not that baby. Come on, young Anglais, listen to me when I talk to you.
I hear you singing in the wire. I can hear you through the whine and the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Last sound you're hearing there, jazz guitarist John Abercrombie. That concludes our tribute to just some of the musicians who died in 2017. Our tribute montage was produced by Tom Cole with research help from Jane Gilvin. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was written by BJ Lederman. It was arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 weekdays here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening throughout 2017. We'll be back, as always, with more Morning Edition in 2018. And remember, if you want to follow news throughout the day, go to our website at wpr.org.
Morning Edition, all things considered. Simply Folk. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, join the Racine Theatre Guild for its 17th season of Gene's Jazz Series. This four-part jazz series will be performing on Saturdays at 7 p.m., January 6th, February 17th, March 24th, and April 21st. RacineTheatre.org.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk